When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses.
Season 19, Episode 24. This is Writing Excuses.
An interview on worldbuilding with Arkady Martin.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Erin.
And with us this week, we have a very special guest. You know, we've spent the last month talking about A Memory Called Empire, and I'm very pleased that we were able to get the author, my friend and also client, Arkady Martin, to join us today to talk about her experience with writing the novel, how she thinks about world building, and some of the stuff that went into it. So, Arkady, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
So obviously I love the book and I've loved it from the very first time it came across my desk. And one of the things that really stands out to us is all the dense and intricate and complex world building that you put into this novel, right? And science fiction fantasy kind of lives and dies on the world building a lot of the time, but this one felt very distinct and unique and special. And I wanted to hear a little bit of where all of that comes from. I know you have like deep academic roots as well in history. And I would love just to hear from you about where the origins of this novel were for you when it comes to the cultures and societies you decided to put in it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great question. So things not to do when you have a postdoc in medieval history in Sweden write a book about the same themes that you were working on in your postdoc instead of writing the academic book that might have gotten you tenure. Because I kind of did that. Which is all to say that I am trained as a Byzantine historian with a specialization in the 11th century, sort of the Eastern frontier, Armenia, Byzantium, bunch of different Arabic-speaking kingdoms. And I'm super interested in diplomacy and letter writing and empires and frontiers. And I spent like a decade of my life doing that professionally as an academic. Except there's this thing about being an academic where you're not really supposed to get really emotionally involved with what you're working on, at least not in how you write it. And I have always been emotionally compelled by that whole suite of subjects. And I've also always written science fiction and fantasy. So there was a point, like the summer after I finished my dissertation, where for complex reasons, I was living in Phoenix for 3 months, which I don't exactly recommend, those 3 months being June, July, and August in Phoenix. Right. And yeah, I decided that I clearly needed another enormous project and that it was getting kind of annoying that I was one of those people who had never successfully written a novel. So clearly I was going to try that, having just put down the 250-page nonfiction thing I'd written. And what came out of that was trying to figure out a way to work on and work through all of that fascination with empire and assimilation and medieval frontiers and frontiers in general, and like spin it through a science fictional lens, and then some stuff that I had always been fascinated by and had written some very juvenile early attempts at novels, like what happens if you have the ghost of the person who used to have your job in your head? The first version I ever tried to write was actually fantasy. That did not go well. It did not last. You wouldn't recognize a bit of it. But anyway, that got in there too. So Byzantium, medieval empire in general, that's the deep basis. And I pulled a ton of little cultural notes out of that. The poetry contests in memory come from that. The dynamic of the succession crisis comes from that. I kind of started with like the succession crisis of Heraclius in like the 600s, and then it doesn't follow, but it starts there. So I used a lot of historical plot to inspire my plot.
Do you think that came from, you know, you were studying this, you were interested in it, you were avoiding writing your nonfiction about it?
Yeah.
So did the impulse to write this novel come from that research and that knowledge? Or as you were working on a fiction project, did you just instinctively reach to the things that you knew? Like, was there a chicken or an egg here?
I'd say like 60% A, 40% B. I really knew I wanted to write about the scenarios that I had encountered in my research. Not a historical novel where I would like tell those stories, but the way I had found myself imagining the emotional impact of living through and experiencing historical events I had been studying. And you can either write a historical book, or you can just take that question and use what I love science fiction for, which is sort of expand it, explode it, and get really, really up close to it. And then as I was writing, because it took me a while to write the book, I had never done this successfully before. I think the longest thing I'd ever written before I wrote memory was like 30,000 words. So it took me about 3 years. I did find myself reaching for tools I knew. And those tools were sometimes things like, oh, I want to do political poetry contests because I love them and I think they're really cool. And I need something like that here. But there was a point also where I deliberately didn't make those choices, where I reached for other tools instead of the instinctive ones on purpose. And I do want to mention before we get away from like direct historical inspiration that Tixkalan is not Byzantines in space exactly. And that's on purpose. Because if I had done Byzantines in space, I would have needed a monotheistic religion. And I really didn't want to write a book about God. That's not this book. Someday I'll write a book about God, but it's not going to be this one. I had too much going on. So I needed to get away from this kind of monism, like one emperor, one God, one like line through history, like this deep teleology that's in Byzantine texts. So I was like, okay, I need a different source that's completely outside of the kind of monotheistic Western traditions. And I ended up being deeply interested in another very complex, very powerful, and quite simultaneous imperial power, which is the Mexica. And I pulled a lot of inspiration from the Mexica, the Aztecs in English, and the way that that empire did assimilation and a lot of its cultural tags, because I didn't want my readers to feel like, well, I knew that my readers were probably going to think that Space Byzantium was just Space Rome, because that's the instinctive thing. And I also wanted to make things weirder than just picking one. So I very much deliberately combined cultural notes.
I mean, it goes back to what you're saying, that you didn't want to write a historical novel, right?
Yeah.
You wanted different aspects in there. So was it a challenge to find a way to pull different elements from two different histories, two different cultures, and blend them? Or was it a pretty straightforward process of like, oh, the names are coming from here, the religion's coming from here, the poetry battles are coming from here?
It felt pretty organic, except for the languages, which I made some pretty sharp choices early on. Because in my early drafts, I was using a lot more Greek in like the backdrop of the Tixkalani language, and it just did not work. And I'm not a conlang person. Like, I don't do this for real. Like, the people who come up with vocabularies, no. But I am a person who unfortunately spent a while taking historical linguistics courses, and I care about phonology. So everything had to sound like it went together and sound culturally appropriate when I used like calcs and made up words. Mm-hmm. But aside from the religion choice, which is probably where I had this moment of, okay, I'm going for a more Mesoamerican feel, it was pretty organic. And that's partially because a lot of medieval empires actually work in very similar ways. So there's more commonality than you'd expect. And secondly, because I was also working off of my own aesthetic sense, like the things I wanted to have. I love flowers. I don't think we do enough with in science fiction in general. Like everything is all chrome and like steel and glass, and it's all very like iPhone. And I find this boring. I like flowers. I like decoration. I like weird architecture. I like a kind of organicism to my science fiction. And all of that led me very easily to Mesoamerican cultures. And while I have not spent a decade of my life immersed in the study of Mesoamerican cultures, I have and am still doing a ton of research there as well. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, obviously, like this question doesn't apply to the Byzantine component so much just because of how much you did there. But like when you're doing the research on Mesoamerican culture, on Mexica and like these ancient empires, like how do you find the line of like, this is enough research, I need to stop researching and start writing? Like, was that a difficult balance for you, or did you just sort of naturally find that flow?
Well, this is why I don't write historicals. because if I wrote a historical, I would have to be able to recreate a depth of field in my world building that matches what we actually know. When I'm working in science fiction, I could do a lot on, I don't want to say just on vibes because that's not enough, but I can do a lot on gestalt. I can do a lot mm-hmm. on in, if I'm pulling this kind of influence and I've got really interested in like, sacrifice rituals. Why do people do them? I don't need to reproduce the argument of what scholars have come up with about why people use sacrifice ritual to accomplish political aims in a particular culture. What I do need to do is understand that myself and get a feel for it so I can get my characters to reproduce that feeling for my audience.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, you were talking about the difference between basically the complexity of, you know, actual history and the complexity of world building, which is, I think, naturally just less complex because there's only so much you can bring in. I wondered, are there areas where you felt like you decided to go like for more complexity versus like more of a, you know, more vibes? And, you know, how did that intersect with the story that you were trying to tell?
So the places I ended up with complexity that I hadn't originally planned to do were where the story I was writing demanded that I know things that never went on the page. And this meant that I have several lists of like, okay, how does the government work? Who works in what department? How are they related? What is their history? When did they develop? None of that needs to be on the page for the story I was telling. All of that needed to be in my head so that I didn't contradict myself. And so that at some point, hopefully, some of the political intrigue stuff resolved into understandable lines of action. I did a similar thing in Desolation when I was trying to work out how the Tixclalli army worked. And how people were promoted and how they moved through it and like how just like the practicalities. And I did a lot of, I guess, what I would think of as traditional world building for that, where I sat down and was like, okay, there are this many legions. Why are they called legions? Because I don't want to deal with coming up with another name for them. how do you become commander of a legion? What happens when you retire? What happens with training? Do people swap jobs? Do people swap like different parts of the military? Like if you are a fighter pilot, are you always a fighter pilot? Or could you end up like a logistics officer? All of that stuff I thought about on purpose and sort of like brainstormed for myself and wrote down so I didn't end up making up something else later on impulse. Mm-hmm. But in terms of some of the other places where I think it looks like I did that, like on the poetry contests, all of that was pretty much, it should feel like this. And I know there are historical examples where this worked, so I can do it.
Right.
It's so interesting. It almost sounds like, it almost sounds like the things that you were more emotionally tied to, you didn't feel as much the need to like research as the things that were like intellectually, you know what I mean? Like you loved the poetry contest. And so like you knew how they needed to feel and didn't need to do as much like note-taking. Maybe I'm wrong there, but yeah, I just found it interesting.
I think you're right, but there's a hidden thing, which is that I had already done the research. I just didn't do it for this project. I didn't do it for fiction. I knew it already. Though I think something like a poetry contest or like anything that becomes more plot or aesthetics or theme, you can kind of like let it exist on its own without having to justify it. You can just decide that's true. And then the question, the world building question to ask afterward is, given that this is true, what else is true? What else must be true? Mm-hmm. And that's actually how I do a lot of world building, like when I am doing it on purpose. Like there's a ton of edible flowers in Tixcalan. And that was a, I think this is cool moment. But in response to that, I thought a great deal about how do these people get their food? What kind of cultural signifiers are there between eating plants and eating animals? And that got more interesting for me because I had characters from a place where eating luxurious food is commonplace and from a place where eating luxurious food is exceedingly rare if it ever happens at all. And eating animals is weird because where would you get a whole animal just to eat it?
I love that moment of her horror at watching somebody eat something that was cut from the side of a cow, right? Like, just like this idea.
Overdetermined steak sandwich.
I would love to talk more. Oh, that scene is an absolute delight. I want to dig into some of the more mechanical things about how you take that amount of world building and make it feel felt and relevant to the characters. But before we dig into that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Hey, writers, are you thinking about learning a new language? I think exploring the world, experiencing other cultures, and being able to communicate with people outside your everyday experience lets you create richer, better stories. A great way to do that is with Rosetta Stone, a trusted expert for over 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. They use an immersive technique which leads to fast language acquisition. It's an intuitive process that helps you really learn to speak, listen, and most of all, think in the language you're trying to learn. They also feature true accent speech recognition technology that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a voice coach in your home. Learn at home or on the go with a desktop and mobile app that let you download and access lessons even when you're offline. And it's an amazing value. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Japanese, and, of course, Korean. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Writing Excuses listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. and the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
My thing of the week is a relatively new novel by Paz Pardo called The Shamshine Blind, which I just finished reading this past weekend, actually. And it is a kind of classical noir, but with a deeply fascinating science fiction premise. And the premise is during the Falklands War, so the war over the Falkland Islands off of Argentina, between Argentina and the UK, the Argentinians came up with a method to kind of, by spraying this special powder on people, they can feel emotions. And those emotions are actually like weapons of mass destruction. And this changes the whole course of history. And the book is set 30 years after that. So it's all part of the backdrop of the world. And it is, I love noir, and I love like noir detectives and how broken down and brutalized they are by their worlds. But having that incredible twist and having the entire noir be rooted in, is this character going to feel emotions that are hers, or is she always going to rely on thinking that emotions are something that are externally imposed? Like, took all the stuff that we love about noir and made it both incredibly thematically obvious and incredibly thematically hidden. And also it was
super fun. It's a great pull for an episode on world building, because the world building ties into the central question of noir, which is this really shut down, emotionally unavailable hero. And then it's like all the world is about these big emotions. And I think that's super cool.
I loved it. I think y'all should read it.
Thank you so much.
You need reliable appliances to help you conquer the day. And Menards is the one-stop shop for huge savings on new energy-efficient appliances. We carry the largest in-stock selection, starting at low prices and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Upgrade today and save big money on new appliances right now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
All right, and we're back. Before we get into sort of the nitty-gritty of the mechanical tools, I have a nitty-gritty process question, which is, you mentioned all these things that you documented and thought about, and I'm kind of curious, like, how did you actually keep track of all that? Like, how did you actually know what you had investigated and what needed to be investigated as you were doing your research?
So I am not anybody's poster child for how to do this in a sensible way. I have a Word document labeled, "What is everyone's motivation?" And that was an editing artifact. But I similarly have a Word document labeled, "The Tlaxcalanli Military," which is just everything I ever thought of that didn't immediately go on a page about the Tlaxcalanli Military. In terms of like research, when I wanted to go find out about something, I basically used a lot of the same methods that I've always used for doing academic or policy work, which is I have a physical notebook and a pen, and I underline things in a document that I'm reading or take notes and mark page numbers. And that just, I just have a million of those. But I didn't do a ton of that at any point for memory and desolation. Some of the things that like look a little bit more like I must do research questions, like some of the biology stuff in book two. And I know you guys haven't talked about book two, but there's like weird alien biology in book two that matters. A lot of that involved medical textbooks and like zoology textbooks. And I didn't exactly take notes so much as like stick post-its all over them. I'm not actually organized, except maybe inside my own head.
Love it.
I love the simplicity of that process. I love just having Word documents that are like, this is about this topic and I know I can reference it. How often did you find yourself going back to like those underlined passages or marked passages? Like, how often did you find yourself having to look stuff up, or was just the act of writing down the military structure enough that it stayed in your brain when you needed to call it up?
The big structure stayed. Like, I understand, I could explain it now, and I haven't written about it directly for a couple years. But the thing that I always have to go back to is if I have named something, I have to write down what I named it. And this can even sometimes extend to characters who actually have speaking parts. The amount of times I've called people like, well, the guy in chapter 3, that guy. but especially if I've done cool names, like names of spaceships, names of continents, names of planets, all of that has to get written down somewhere, because I will forget it and I will make up a new cool thing and confuse people, including myself.
And suddenly you just have 10 cool things, 10 cool planets you didn't need, you know?
Yeah, or you've named absolutely everybody in book 2, the number sign 2, and then a word starting with C, and you hadn't noticed until you did the dramatis personae at the end.
Yeah.
I have to wonder now, and this may be the question we were getting at before we went to break, which is, so you've got all this stuff, because I find sometimes people do a lot of research and they know a lot of stuff, but then it's hard to like translate it into making the world come alive, which your world absolutely does. So how do you take all these things that you know and then like make it, you know, exciting and juicy and wonderful for all of us readers?
It's character work, which is to say it's theme. And I know that sounds weird, but they are for me very, very close. The things that I want to show the reader, I'm going to show them through either a close point of view with a character or through a deliberately selected broader point of view, like an omniscient or one of the more fun ones, like a second person or like a unreliable first person narrator who's telling you a story. So the speaker, the voice is always going to point out specific things about the world. And those are choices that I'm making that guide the reader's like mental eye, I guess. What do I want the reader to notice? Because the reader doesn't need to know what research I did in 99% of cases. I mean, I love footnotes, but most of the time fiction doesn't need them. The reader has to want to come along with me, so I need to give them a reason to keep looking in the direction I'm pointing. And that's usually the inside of a character's head. Why is that character looking at the thing? Why do we need to know? Or it's a POV voice that is also pointing something out to the reader that is doing a frame. I'm a very structure and theme oriented writer. I like playing games. The Tixkillon books are actually pretty straightforward for me. They go in one direction, and while most of the characters are unreliable, they're not unreliable on purpose. They are trying to tell you what they see. And in a way, that directness lets me do more with the world, because I'm not ever letting or making the character voice or the authorial voice deliberately misdirect the reader. So the reader is, if I tell the reader to look at something, like look at these buildings, look at this edible flower, look at all of the strange clothes people are wearing for reasons that are political, I'm telling them that because it's story important or character important or creates a sense of thematic unity. And that keeps the reader with me, even when I'm doing a bunch of fancy footwork.
Mm-hmm. You immediately tie character and theme together, right? And you're also underlying the underlining the way that world building and theme are connected. When you're thinking of a character, are you thinking of like them being your lens on a specific thematic element and therefore a specific world building element? Or is it more scene by scene? Oh, this is a good time for Mahit to illustrate this aspect of assimilation or of how language works. Or, you know, like, are you looking at it on like a very granular level, or are you starting at a real high level of like, this character is about assimilation, this character is about succession, this character is about, you know, whatever it happens to be?
Well, they're all about assimilation and they're all about succession. But some of them...
I picked the broadest ones. I'm sorry.
No, sorry. Mahit is in some ways, I'm glad I stuck with only her point of view, except for little tiny interludes in the whole book, or the whole first book, because she has a very narrow thematic lens that lens has a very wide scope. Her lens is she is from the border, and she wants to be assimilated if that meant something different than what it does. And that sounds complex, but it's actually kind of like a pretty focused thematic lens, but that touches absolutely everything she sees. So I can just pick that up whenever I need it and pull back to it whenever I want to sort of ground the reader in it. And it also is one that lets me show off all the world, because Mahit loves it, but it's also new to her. And it also is going to make her think and be uncomfortable. So I get to do all those things while I'm showing the reader what I've made. And they'll hopefully stay with me because they care about how she is seeing what she's seeing.
I love what you said about the width and the depth of the lens, of the thematic lens and the character lens. I'm wondering if there's an example that comes to mind of you of somebody who has a very different set of lenses and how that impacts the way they see and you portray the world, if that makes sense.
In memory specifically, or anywhere?
I mean, I think you can talk about Desolation if you wanted. I mean, our readers won't be as familiar with it, mm-hmm. so like, be a little bit more careful about spoilers, but like, that's the one that has more POVs,
yeah.
So I can
it's
see that
easier
being.
Easier to talk about in Desolation, but I think it might be more mm-hmm. interesting to think about in memory, because... Well, there's one scene in memory that I desperately wanted to write from someone's point of view that wasn't Mahit, and I didn't do it. And I actually didn't even let myself do it for fun, because it would have ruined it for me if I had done it like the way that would have hit like the squids in your id for me, which is so the poisoning scene, the aftermath of the poisoning scene with the flower in the hallway and 19 Ads and Mahit. I wanted so much to write that from 19 Ads' point of view, and it would have ruined the book. Like, the book does not work if you do that. But oh my God.
It doesn't, but I do want to see it,
right?
Though, you know?
Yeah. But that scene played in my head from her point of view, and I kind of had to like write it deliberately, like reacting against that instinct. And 19 Ads has a very different lens than Mahit. 19 Ads' lens is actually... Well, in memory, it is about dealing with being in charge and dealing with being middle-aged, and also grief, and also like deliberately not making choices that you might have made before, like not repeating your own mistakes. That's what she's thinking about all the time, which enables her to make new mistakes, which is always fun. But the way that she approaches that scene is from a position of a lot of knowledge and a lot of power, and also a position of incredible amounts of emotional stress, which by the time you get to the end of the book, you have figured out why she's under that much emotional stress, because she very nearly has decided to commit murder again and then doesn't and then has to deal with it. And like, also there's like endocrine stuff about sex and desire and death. So that scene would have been really fun from her point of view, but very different and thematically very different. It would have pulled the thematic lens of the book to be about questions of rulership rather than questions of assimilation. Like, what do you owe people? Mm-hmm. What do you owe people when you have power? Which is like one of my favorite questions in the world to write about. And it's a lot more there in Desolation, like on the surface. And in part, that's because of who else gets point of view in Desolation. But it is an undercurrent in Memory where the question of, okay, you have power. What do you do now? What responsibilities do you have? Can you abdicate them? Those questions are there from a heat, but they're underground.
Mm-hmm. When you conceived of the novel, was it always from Mihit's perspective? Like, were you always intending it to be from the perspective of this outsider who's new to this place, who loves this place? You know, like, she has, you're right, that super wide lens, but also all of that depth, which is almost like very impossible to get in a certain way. Did she come to you at the beginning, or was that a thing that arose partway through to solve a problem for you?
She was there from the beginning. The question I had about midway through writing was whether I was going to add anybody else. And I thought about that a lot. And it would have been a very different kind of book had I. Because, so structurally, at least the very first draft of Memory is a information control spy novel, which means that the audience and the main character should find out what's going on at approximately the same time. And the questions about what is happening in the world are hyper-dependent on who knows what. If I added more people, I could have shown a lot more things, but it would have been a novel that wasn't about what does Mihit know and when does she know it. That would not have been the plot driver that allowed me to move the story forward. So I thought about it a lot, and I did not do it because, in part because I was absolutely terrified of what that would do. Remember that I had never written a whole novel before, and it seemed difficult enough to deal with one person, and also to try to like go back and layer in more people. I also thought about that in some of the revisions that I considered and essentially voted against it, except for very, very small bits. And the interludes are not, in fact, in tight third like everything else. The interludes are in a kind of omniscient third on purpose. Mm-hmm. Because
This were a late, late edition.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Not the first revision I did, which got me the manuscript that I submitted to you, Dongwon. And I think like maybe not even the first revision I did for my editor might have been there, might have been the second one when I realized I had accidentally,
in the first or second revision. Yeah.
Yeah. I collapsed too much motivation into one character and needed him to be two people. I still think I probably could have ended up with three people, but it was getting hard to get them all on screen.
Yeah, it's already a big book, you know?
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I believe you have some homework for us as well.
I do. So this is a prompt about world building through observation. And I actually, to my delight, I think we've set it up really well in this conversation. And it is using the character in the story that you are currently working on. It can be your main character or somebody else. Look at the nearest building you can see out your window and describe it from their point of view. What does that say about the world that you are in and the world that they are in?
I love that. I love returning to that idea of the lens and the focus and all of that. Arkady, thank you so much for joining us. This conversation was an absolute delight.
It was super fun. Thank you for having me.
And with that, you're out of excuses. Now go write.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Aaron Roberts and Dongwon Song. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Complete your staining project with Pittsburgh Paints and Stains now at Menards. Stain in one coat with Ultra Advanced Semi-Transparent Stain. It's a stain and sealant in one that can be applied to damp wood and on hot, sunny days, allowing you to clean and stain your deck in one day. Save big money on Pittsburgh Paints and Stains and head into Menards to get your staining project started today.
Save